We've been having a clear out at home, you know, as you do every so often, and filing cabinets and old documents that go back over the years and years and years and years. So much so that we broke our shredder. We had to get another one. It sort of burned out after a bit. So we were doing that in the study that where we got most of our equipment. So I thought, well, I'm going to go through some of my own personal filing cabinet where I've got different documents, etc., etc. It's quite interesting what you find that you've got in your... David's not here, but I've got his report. I didn't... Well, say no more. I read it and I thought, oh. But anyway, I can tell him about that at another time. It's quite interesting reading when you look... Pardon? Yes. Oh, absolutely, Mike. Very interesting, looking back. Oh, dear. Yes, and a few other interesting things. But anyway, and then I've, over the years, I've preached hundreds of sermons, actually, when you sort of look about. I've got all my old sermons. I've even got the one that I first preached at Bible college when you had to be examined by all the other students. Sermons have got longer notes to them. Some have just got a page. Some that you don't have notes at all, and others are big ones, short ones, and everything else like that. So I thought, oh, I'm going to start reading some of these old sermons that I preached. And it's quite interesting. And I've been blessed, actually, by some of the thoughts. I thought, oh, that was interesting. That was a blessing. But anyway, coming back to it, I was looking through some, and I thought, oh, I'll have to preach some of these again, because they were blessing me, and not that I haven't sometimes done it, but I came across one, and I was going to preach something else this week, actually, until yesterday afternoon, when I was just thinking, I don't know if it was yesterday afternoon or even early this morning, but I thought, no, I won't preach what I was going to preach. I'm going to preach on this one. So the title of this message is If Not. And I may have preached it more than once over the years, but we're going back 40 years, really, or whatever. It's, and the Bible college was 50 plus whatever years it was. But we often use the phrase, don't we? A lot of us use the phrase, but if not, I'll do this, but if not. And it's an indication, really, of when we're doing it, that very often when that happens, it's altering our plans, isn't it? We're going to we plan to do one thing, but if not, then we'll alter it and we'll do something else. And sometimes when we alter plans, sometimes they're under our control and we choose to do that, we change our mind. Or sometimes, or more often than not, they're altered by circumstances, aren't they, that are beyond our own control. And sometimes when things are changed we're not too upset, because in actual fact the alternative isn't as bad, or it's equally as good. And sometimes actually the alternative can turn out to be better than we actually planned for the original. So it doesn't mean too much if we say, well, if not. But sometimes there's a big difference between the two, isn't there, of something that we want to do or plan to do. And those little words, just two little words, if not, can cause our plans to come crashing down at our feet. And some of us, and maybe a lot of folks, have actually had that happen. And when you think about it, it starts really even from the time that we're born, or even before we're born. Because how many of us that have been married and have had children, and we're expecting the first child... And you want either a boy or a girl, depending on your choice of whether you think one's going to be easier to raise than another. And then, but you think, well, before you could find out what you were having, and it would be, well, I'd like a boy, but if not, I'm going to love my daughter just the same. Or I want a daughter, but if not. So it can start really from the very time that we're actually, even before we're born, it's happening to our parents. And then when the children are born, then you have, as we go along, well, you come to that, which is much more difficult nowadays, but which school to send them to. And you have a plan, don't you? You want, there's this particular school that you'd like them to go to because of the reputation or because of other things that it offers. And nowadays, of course, it's not always as easy to get your child into the school that you want, whether it's junior school, senior school, whatever. But you get to that place where you say, well, I'd like them to go to such and such. But if not, so what is the if not? Sometimes the if not is okay, it's not so bad, doesn't matter. Sometimes the if not can be quite a challenge, quite a disappointment. And used to be much more so in throughout the whole of the country when it was the 11 plus that was all the way through the country. Now it's only just in certain counties that they do it. When you get, you know, hoping your child might go or the child wants to go and they don't, you know, all those disappointments. And it's if not. And that can come across as well, can't it, with exams. When you hope to get a particular exam, whether it's in school or whether later in life, etc. And what do you do if you don't get what you expected? And many of us have been in places like that. And it's all part of life, isn't it? And I can remember when I was 17, I'd left school because in those days we didn't used to stay on to, you know, most of us did, we didn't used to go on to university so much. I think we were all so glad to get away from some schools. I was, couldn't wait for the day that I could go out of the school dates and never return to the horrible place again. But I was in college and I was finishing a sort of a course, etc. there, and I was 17, and my father was in the Air Force. So every 2 years or so we'd move from one place to another. So we'd lived abroad. I'd lived abroad in Germany when I was a child. Then I'd lived in Aden when I was a teenager, 12 to 14, that sort of age. And now at 17, my father was due a posting again. And it was a posting abroad. We knew it was going to be a posting abroad. So my brother had left home. He was in the Air Force. And so we were waiting expectantly, excitedly, that we would be posted either to Cyprus or to the Far East, somewhere warm. My mother and I, being hothouse plants, we wanted to go somewhere warm. But we didn't get sent there. And it was a question of, well, if we go there, you know, but if not. And we were posted, my father was posted back to Germany. Now, I didn't want to go back to Germany again. I'd been there as a child, I'd liked it, I loved it, but I wanted somewhere different, somewhere warmer. And I had the chance, I had the choice to make. Well, you can either come to Germany, but if not, then you stay home here with your aunt or you do this, that and the other. I had a choice, and it was an if not choice, if or an if not. And I could have stayed at home and etc. But my choice was then that I thought, well, I might as well go to Germany, see what it's like, and if not, I can always come home. That was how I went. That was the biggest disappointment as regards going to Cyprus or the Far East. But the best thing that happened to me as a teenager. Because when I went to Germany and I got a job, some would think, wow, you got a job in the British Embassy at only the age of 17. That was quite something. It wasn't a great job, by the way, but and nevertheless, I lived there. But because of somebody I met there, I went to a barbecue dance, I met Ken, eventually got saved, and now I'm here. And that was an if or an if not situation in my life. And we have them, don't we? And what we think are disappointments can turn out to be the biggest challenge or biggest change in our lives and take us along a road that we never ever thought that we'd ever go through. And so that was something life-changing to me. And it's the same in jobs, isn't it? In promotion, you know, you hope to get on, you hope to get a promotion, and you think, oh, if Mr. X retires, then maybe I'll get his position, etc. But if not, and it doesn't turn out that way. There's also the sport, isn't it? Sometimes you want to go into sport, you want to be good at this, you want to be good at the other, if you've got that sort of aim in life. And you want to be picked in the school team, you want to be chosen for this, that and the other. You train hard, you want to win. But if not, there's always that if not to life, isn't there? Something doesn't happen. And then, as well as young people, what about marriage? And how many times that we may have seen somebody as a teenager, as a young person, that you think, oh, I like that person, and you hope for something, you hope that something will come out of a relationship, that there will be marriage coming out of it. But if not, and how many hearts have actually been broken in those ways, haven't they? But if not, now, to some extent, some of these things are under our control. I could have chosen not to go to Germany. And then in a way of sport, you can choose to train, not to train, to enter into competition or not to. And with marriage, etc. as well, some of it is in our control and some of it is out of our control. But there are certain things that we can do, and they're out of our control. Now, I don't know about you, but whenever I watch certain things on the television, sporting things, because I used to be quite good at sport, you know, when I was younger, and I could always have won Wimbledon. I could always have won Wimbledon. Then when the ice skating comes on, I could have been a wonderful ice skater, twirling around on the ice, etc., etc. I could have been a great gymnast. It's all in my mind. And my imagination. It's amazing what we could have been, isn't it? And we always have that dream, etc., etc. But I'm not. So it's an if or it's an if not. And so things like that, I would have enjoyed it, but I would never have been a world champion. And so certain things like that are out of our control. You've either got it or you haven't in certain aspects of life and sport and everything else like that. And in the question of when you love somebody and they don't love you back, that's completely out of your control. So whether we control circumstances or not, we have to come and face the fact that our plans have come to naught, that something that we've wanted or planned to do, it's if not. We're left with the if not. And what do we do with the if not? How do we react when things don't work out? And they don't, many, many times in our lives. And there's one verse probably that we all love when everything's going wonderfully well, but we all hate when it's not going wonderfully well. And you all know what I'm going to say to you. It's the verse that everybody says to you in good faith and good feeling and motive, but you could strangle them sometimes, and you smile at them and say, thank you very much. But you're thinking, Lord, I don't understand this. We do know that all things work together for good to them that love the Lord and that are called according to his purpose. We know that, but when you're going through an if not experience, it's not easy to handle, is it? Not quite so easy. So we can react in a positive way and really believe that scripture and trust the Lord, or if you're more like me, you can complain a bit and tell the Lord that you've been treated a bit badly and et cetera, et cetera, and you look at others and you know all the things that we can do when we're in that particular state. But what I wanted to do tonight is just look at a couple of characters again, and you probably know one of them that I'm going to go through straight away. How some Bible characters, how they reacted when their plans or their hopes for their lives were dramatically and drastically changed by circumstances that were beyond their control. Now, that happened to a lot of them, didn't it? A lot of them. You can think about a lot of them. But they were completely in God's control. And I want to go back to Daniel, and I want to go to the story of Shadrach, Meshach and Abednego, because that's where the famous phrase comes from, isn't it? If not, if not. And Shadrach, Meshach and Abednego, we know the story. They'd been taken captive, along with Daniel, when Nebuchadnezzar besieged Jerusalem in the time and the reign of Jehoiakim. He was the second one. His older brother, or one of his brothers, had been king after Josiah died. He was only king for a few months until Pharaoh of Egypt took him into Egypt. And so then he put his brother Jehoiakim in control. And Jehoiakim reigned, I think, about 11 years. But during his reign, we're told in chapter 1 of Daniel, that during his reign, then Nebuchadnezzar came, and he took captive and prisoner the first group of prisoners that were taken. And he took the cream of the land. He took the cream of the crop. He took the royalty. He took the nobility. He took the educated ones, the noble birth. He took the ones that had certain qualifications. The ones that really had a wonderful future ahead of them. These were the nobility of the land. These were the cream, the educated ones. And as young men, they would have thought where their plans were going to go, what they were going to do in the Lord, what they were going to be, and etc., etc. But it didn't turn out like that. And I wonder, even as young people, whether they ever even thought of an if not. I don't think they did. They would have thought, this is my life, this is what it's going to be like. They wouldn't even added the words, but if not, because it was all there for them, all there for the taking. But unfortunately, we know it was taken away from them. And we know that they were physically strong, they were healthy, they were well-educated, they were well-mannered, because the king, Nebuchadnezzar, wanted those that could behave themselves in the court, and they were well-bred. They had everything going for them. But here they are, the three of them, with Daniel, ending up in Nebuchadnezzar's court and being trained to be the bright people of his country, etc. We know the tests that they had when they refused to eat the king's meat that had been offered to idols. And then for 10 days they just ate bread and vegetables. And God honoured their stand because they were standing for righteousness and holiness, and they're keeping the laws of God. That's basically what they were doing. But they knew the hand of the Lord in their lives, because the Lord delivered them from any punishment, etc., etc. And it seemed a very small matter, didn't it? And it was a small matter in one sense, but it was a very big matter, because it was the beginning of them learning to trust the Lord and for the Lord to undertake them. And they proved God in a small thing, but they were then tested, we know that, to prove him in even greater things. And so often, as Christians, especially as young Christians, we want to prove the Lord in great things, don't we? You know, we get saved, we're going to be doing this, that and the other, and we're going to see this. But it doesn't work out that way. And God has to test and train us in the small things. He that's faithful in that which is least is faithful in much. And the Lord said, well done, thou good and faithful servant. You've been faithful over a few things, and I will make you ruler over many things. So this is where they're at. And then we know that Nebuchadnezzar has the dream, and Daniel translates it and interprets it, should I say. And then Nebuchadnezzar sets up the image of gold, and he commands everybody to worship towards it when the music sounds. And they know, these three young men, we're not told where Daniel is at this particular time, but these three young men know that failure to do this and to bow at the idol meant death. And it wasn't just an execution with a sword. It was death, one of the most horrific types of death you can die, an agonizing death, to be burnt in a fiery furnace. Even to just burn your finger on a fire is painful enough, isn't it? So you've got the test of faith and courage of these three men. And they had to bow or they would burn. It was as simple as that. And Peter, whether he was thinking about this in his letter, he says, the trial of your faith, being much more precious than of gold that perishes, though it be tried with fire, might be found unto praise and honour. And you know, that faith has been tried by fire, hasn't it, by many Christians in our country. And I'll mention that just a little bit in a minute. But whether he was thinking of Shadrach, Meshach and Abednego, I don't know. He could well have been. But their faith was tried, not just by a fire, a spiritual fire. It was tried by a physical fire. That was the cost of their denying to worship the idol. These three men had made enemies because of their godly living. And so their enemies were quick to tell Nebuchadnezzar that they weren't bowing. And it's just one of those things that if you live a godly life, we will suffer persecution to a measure. A lesser or a greater one. That's what the Lord said. He says, if you or Timothy, it's in all that live godly lives will suffer persecution. And Jesus said, woe to you if all men will speak evil of you. But I was thinking about this as well. We all have tests, don't we? We all have our fires of faith, just like these men did, these young men. If we go through our fires down here, then hopefully most of the rubbish will be burnt up out of our lives. All the dross, all the rubbish and the things that shouldn't be there, that don't bring glory to God. They will be burnt up so that when we stand before the judgment seat of Christ, there won't be so much to be burnt. And we won't be ashamed of the way we live. Because I was thinking about this there was a time in Christian circles that said, you know, there's different teaching sort of has a cyclical way of being ministered, etc. And you don't hear about the judgment seat of Christ very often now, do you? There was a time in years and years ago, and in my Christian experience, maybe because I was first saved, maybe it was the ones that I was mixing with and the different ones, but the judgment seat of Christ was preached very, very much in the churches. And heaven is not a place that's just going to be wonderful, etc. We tend to think, you know, it's going to be just wonderful and we're just going to go to be in the presence of the Lord and it's going to be all wonderful. It is after the judgment seat of Christ, because we're all going to stand before the judgment seat of Christ. I'm not talking about the white throne judgment for the judgment of all mankind and the saved to one side, the unsaved to another. But we're going to stand before the judgment seat of Christ. And in Corinthians it says, if any man builds upon this foundation, our salvation, etc., gold, silver, precious stones, or wood, hay, or stubble, every man's work shall be made manifest. It will be revealed, for the day shall declare it, because it shall be revealed by fire. And the fire shall try or prove every man's work of what sort it is. If any man's work abide which he has built thereon, he shall receive a reward. If any man's work shall be burned, he shall suffer loss, but he himself shall be saved, yet so as by fire. Now, it's not my purpose to preach on the judgment seat of Christ, but that's going to happen, isn't it? There is a fire that we all have to face, actually, about how we've lived, what we've done, etc., etc., etc. And we have this in the Old Testament with Shadrach, Meshach and Abednego. But it is a challenge to how we live, isn't it? Maybe we ought to mention it a bit more often and think about it a bit more often. And we maybe would walk more circumspectly before the Lord and watch what we say and do, etc. And how we live and how we are in the world. But these three men decided that they would never bow. And the Bible tells us in Daniel that Nebuchadnezzar flew into a rage. He was furious. And at one stage later on, it says his face distorted because he was so angry. And you can see the anger of this man. How dare these young men that I've trained, that I've brought into my palace, that I've trained, that I've done all of this, that and the other, how dare they not bow down to this image of mine? Who do they think they are? You can see this, and it's very interesting that men who lose control of themselves, who are despots, can do and say the most horrendous things. And many of them, when their tempers cooled down, have actually regretted what they've done. But it's too late then. Hitler was a man like that. But Nebuchadnezzar thought he was a great man. Wasn't he the ruler of the greatest nation and empire on the earth? And he was really saying that there's no one greater than me on the fair. And we know that later on, because that's what happens when he gets cut down by the Lord, remember, and that Daniel tells him about that he's going to be eating grass, etc., for the 7 years, and he's insane. But the two questions he asked them, it shows his arrogance. He says, is it true, Shadrach, Meshach and Abednego, that you're not going to serve my gods and worship the idol I have set up? What other god apart from mine is worth worshipping? That's his attitude. And then he confirms it. Who is that God that will deliver you out of my hands? So we see the arrogance of this man here. And they've always been there, and always will be there. You know, the Bible definition of a great man is he that is slow to anger. He's better than the mighty. And he that rules his spirit, greater than he that can conquer a city. That's the definition of a great man. But their answer is, our God, whom we serve, is able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace. They knew the power of the Lord. They proved the Lord in their own experience in those 10 days, etc., etc. They knew that the Lord could do anything because he was mightier than any of the gods of Babylon. They had their Old Testament up until that date. They had the history of their nation. They had the miracles that God had performed. They had a trust in the Lord. And they refused to compromise. And I think one of the biggest dangers to Christians is compromise. And we can so easily do it, every one of us, about little things in particular. And they could have refused, or they could not. They could have compromised, and they had a chance to do it. And you know, I've been mentioned, I think, at the women's meeting, etc. I've been looking at a few on the iPlayer, different documentaries that the BBC have been showing just over the past weeks, etc., on the Reformation, because it was 500 years ago, on the 31st of October, that Martin Luther nailed his 95 theses to the cathedral door. So there's been a lot of information about the Reformation, how it affected our country, what happened under Henry VIII, what happened under Edward and Elizabeth and Mary, etc., etc. And it talks about the different ones who lost their lives. And there was one particular one, it was Thomas Cranmer. In actual fact, he kept his views a little bit to himself under the reign of Henry VIII. But when Edward, who was a Protestant king, a young boy, came to the throne, Cranmer wrote the Common Book of Prayer that eventually was given throughout the whole of the country. And during the reign of Edward, he was able to share it, and it was put throughout, etc., because Edward was a Protestant and Britain was a Protestant country. But Edward died young, and his sister Mary took the throne. And she was an absolute staunch Catholic. And she, within the first few months of her reign, I don't know how many hundreds of Protestants were put to death. And Cranmer knew that his time was up. And he was taken before the courts, etc. And he signed some different papers and he recanted. And he said that he no longer believed what he had written in the Common Book of Prayer, etc., etc., etc. And that he asked their forgiveness and everything like that. And it was given, but he was still going to die. And then he was taken before, I can't remember which cathedral it was, and this particular preacher preached, you know, against him and all the things and talked about the Catholic faith. And then Cranmer got up. And he had told them what he was going to say. They had a copy, I believe, of what he was going to address the people and say. But he didn't. He stood up there and he said that he had asked God's forgiveness for signing those documents, and that he no longer was recanting from them, but he believed everything that he had written in the Common Book of Prayer, and he preached again to the shouts and abuse from the congregation, etc., etc. And he came back to the Lord. You know, he had compromised, but he came back in that sense to the Lord and asked forgiveness. But this was the thing that struck me. He was burnt at the stake. They took him out. They had all the stuff around. And from the fire, he held his hand out like that. And he said, "By this hand," this is, I'm putting in my own words, "by this hand I offended the Lord by signing what I did not believe." He said, "This is the first part that must be burnt." I thought, what a thing to do. What a man to do. And so he was a man that went through literal fire. Shadrach, Meshach and Abednego weren't burnt. Cranmer and many, many others were burnt at the stake in the most horrendous and terrible ways. Sometimes you can't even recount at some of the things that happened to them and what they did. But it's coming back to Shadrach, Meshach and Abednego. It was just that little verse in verse 18 of the chapter, "But if not, our God is able to deliver us, but if not." They wanted God to deliver them, of course they did, and be glorified in that deliverance, but they were willing to submit themselves to his will and even die. And as I say, many martyrs. Tyndale was martyred, others were martyred during the time of the Reformation. But our Christianity is not the same today, is it? It's not, we're not tested in the same particular way, but But if we are completely surrendered to the Lord, as these men and women were, then it's going to be tested in some way, one way or another, isn't it? And we know that. And we'll always have a choice. It won't be maybe a choice of life or death, but there is always a choice. And we know that the Lord was with them. Because if I think it's a tremendous story, this, and I'm not, as I say, majoring on this particular part, but they threw them into the fiery furnace. The soldiers were killed by the heat of the fire. They were thrown into the fiery furnace. Well, I've got to read the verses. And then it says, Nebuchadnezzar was full of fury, etc., etc. He commanded certain men of valor to throw them in, and they were killed. And then it says, and these three men, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, fell down bound into the midst of the burning fiery furnace. It's so hot that it's just killed, because he's been heated seven times greater. Then King Nebuchadnezzar was astonished, and he rose in haste and spoke, saying to his counselors, did we not cast three men bound into the midst of the fire? And they answered and said to him, true, O king. Look, he answered, I see four men loose, walking in the midst of the fire, and they are not hurt, and the form of the fourth is like the Son of God. Well, there's been many a sermon preached on that, but what an experience these men had. The Lord himself came down into the fiery furnace because those men had said, if not. And the Lord came, and they had, as one man said, they had a Jericho march all around, and they were more free inside the fire than they were outside the fire. And we know that they didn't smell of fire or burning or anything. But they had been prepared not to compromise and to go, what we would say, all the way with the Lord. And they have a tremendous testimony to that. It's really a fulfillment, isn't it? And I wonder if they had this in mind, because 100 years or so before they were faced with this, the prophet Isaiah had prophesied many, many things, but this is one of the things he'd said. When you walk through the fire, you shall not be burned, neither shall the flame kindle upon you. Whether they had that verse in mind or not, I don't know. But the Lord certainly honoured that verse to them. I want to go on now to somebody else, and that's Esther. And although that we know the book of Esther is found a lot earlier in the scriptures, way back in Ezra, Nehemiah, Esther, etc., because it's a history book, but Esther actually took place a good maybe 30, 40 or so years after this particular occurrence, because Babylon, Nebuchadnezzar and his etc., and his grandson was Belshazzar. And it was conquered by the Medes and the Persians, and they come and they take over. And Ahasuerus, who was also known as Xerxes, so I'll probably call him Xerxes because that's easier to say than Ahasuerus, he was the Persian king. And we know the story. Mordecai was the cousin of Esther. They had been living probably in Babylon, in the capital there, but they were moved to Shushan, which was the capital of Persia. And that's where they were moved to. Esther was an orphan. We're not told how her parents died, but she was raised by her cousin Mordecai. So she'd already had tragedy in her life, hadn't she? She'd lost her parents. We're not told how young or how old she was, but she was an orphan, raised by her cousin Mordecai. And Esther had plans for her life, just like any other young Jewish girl. In one sense, they wouldn't have been great plans because they were captives. Whether she had plans and thoughts about maybe would she be alive at the time of the going back of the captivity or whatever, we don't know. But as an ordinary Jewish girl, she would have had plans. She would have wanted to meet, or be, if it was an arranged marriage or whatever, the right man for her. She would have wanted to marry, because that's what every Jewish woman would want. They would want to be in the line of the Messiah as well. She would want to raise a family. She would want to teach them in the ways of the Lord. She would want to be a good wife and a mother. She would want to be part of the Jewish community. She would want to go to the synagogue or whatever on the Sabbath, etc., etc., and do all of those things that would please the Lord, and that she would walk in the ways of the Lord. She was subservient to her cousin. She didn't expect a great position in life, did she? She was a captive in Babylon, in Persia now. And she had to say, if not, on more than one occasion in her life. We have the story, it opens up in Esther with the disobedience of Vashti and Xerxes' absolute fury. And when you consider this, here was this drunken king having this party with all his people, etc. And then he calls for his wife Vashti, who's the most beautiful woman, etc., to come, and he wants to parade her in front of all these men. For what reason, we don't know. Maybe just a boast, etc., etc. And she refuses to come. And we know the story. She's dishonoured, she's taken out of the way, and she's no longer queen. It always, and this is just about a digression here, but it always amuses me that those who Christians who are very, very strong on male domination and headship and the submissiveness of women and subjection of women in many ways, they use this story sometimes as a reason for men to be in control. Because when Vashti does this, the king is furious, he's half drunk, and he says, what am I going to do? And so they come and say, well, if you don't punish her and do something about it, then all the other women in the country are going to rise up against their husbands, and then the husbands are not going to be in control of their own homes anymore, and you've got to do something about it to make sure that every man is got control of his own home. And they use that passage to emphasize the fact that every man should be ruler, etc., in his own home. And I think, please look at the context of this. This is a drunken man doing this. And I think if he had been a godly man with one wife, as it was said in the beginning, Adam and Eve, etc., have one wife. If he had had a good relationship with his wife, if he wasn't drunken, if he wasn't doing all of this, this would never have happened, would it? Would never have happened. And when he does do what he does, and he becomes sober again, he regrets it. And that's when he has to look for another woman to take Esther's place. We have to be careful what scriptures we use, don't we, to back up certain doctrines, etc. That's the sort of man that he was. So now he's sober, so he wants a new queen. He's got all these other concubines, etc., but he wants a new queen. They're telling him to get a new queen. Do you think Esther wanted to be the wife of Xerxes? No decent, moral Jewish girl would ever want to be as a concubine or a queen of this man. But Mordecai said, and I believe it was under the leading of God, we know that, but he puts her forward. That was his prerogative and his right to do that, because they wanted all the beautiful young women of the empire. And she submitted herself to Mordecai's wishes. And then she was taken to the palace, and for a whole year, it was the custom of those days to prepare the girls, etc., and do all sorts of different things. Can you imagine what it was like for her, for a whole year, to be in the atmosphere of all those other girls and women? I don't know how many there were, but women together are not the nicest of people to be with when they're like that. Can you imagine the jealousies? Can you imagine the comments that were made? Can you imagine the looks that were made? And the different, that went on for a whole year. They all wanted to be the queen. Esther didn't. She was there because she was submissive. But do you think she really wanted to be this queen of this man? But it was a question, if not. If I'm not released, if I'm not whatever, but if not. And she submits herself. She doesn't dress like everybody else does, and we know the story how she's favoured by the man that was looking after them, and she's given the most beautiful of things. But she had an inward beauty, and the scripture talks about it, and Peter, doesn't it? It says, not all the but what you do with your hair and all the jewellery that you use. He said, it's got to be a meek and quiet spirit in the sight of God, which is very pleasing. They went into the king in turn at the end of the year, went in the evening, returned in the morning. So we know what that entailed. They all spent the night with the king. Did Esther really want that? No. Especially with the risk that she may not be chosen. And for the rest of her life, she would be a concubine of this ungodly king with all the others. And she would probably be saying, I may be chosen as queen, but if not, I'm willing to submit myself to the will of God. Although she didn't want to be queen, to be the queen would have been better than to be a concubine, wouldn't it? You know, that she would have some sort of honour or recognition. And she became the king, the queen. And her whole life changed from that moment on. And then the second time it happened, very briefly, was the story of Haman's plot to destroy all the Jews. He wanted to destroy the Jews because of his hatred of Mordecai, who wouldn't bow down to him. And Esther had to go into the presence of the king and plead for her people. And we know the penalty for entering the king's room without being called was death, even for the queen. And sometimes we can look at these passages and we think, oh, how barbaric that was. How terrible. You know, that's what took place and was still taking place in our country 500 years ago. Under that, the reigns of King Henry VIII, or even Queen Elizabeth and the others, and the kings and queens that came after them. If you didn't please them, if you did something that was against their wishes or any thought of them, they had the power of life and death, and many of the one went to the Tower of London and had their head cut off. So it's not that long ago in our own nation when this sort of thing was taking place. So when we look at it and we think, oh, well, it's a little bit exaggerated. People think, you know, she wouldn't have had her head cut off. Yes, she would. Henry VIII cut off two of his wife's heads. So it was a real thing for this lovely Esther. And as she was going in, she would have been thinking, he may smile at me. He may be gracious to me. But if not, if not. It took courage, didn't it? To trust the Lord for all that he was able to do for her. But she was prepared for the if not. And I've mentioned those because we know that the Lord honoured Esther, and he honoured as he did with Shadrach, Meshach and Abednego. And I mention them because it's so dramatic, isn't it, in their lives. It's not always as dramatic as that in our lives. It's not always a question of life and death. But sometimes there are things that do go well, and sometimes there are things that don't go well. And sometimes we have a choice to make, if not. And I ever want to have the attitude, and I haven't had it throughout my life, I have to admit that, when things don't go the way that I would like them to go. And I've reacted in the wrong way. But I just want to be in a place where I say, Lord, but if not, I know that you have a better plan. I know that you have something greater for my life than what I think that you have at the moment. And who knows what we face in our own nation? We don't know, do we? The way things are going, brothers and sisters, I'm not saying it in a negative way, but there are things that we are going to have to pay a price for. The way it's going, we're going to have choices to make. They might seem little at the time, but they might have bigger consequences to them. But we have to come, and it's just been a challenge. I suppose the reason it's been challenging me more is because of the videos I've been watching about the Christians, the price they paid in our nation. You know, it's Remembrance Day, as we've said, and everybody has been remembering those that have lost their lives for the freedom of our nation. My own reaction is, what really did they die for? They died for our freedom, yes, but the spiritual and the moral state of our nation is, well, it's dreadful. And I think if some of them came back and saw what they died for, I wonder if they'd been quite so willing to have done so. Who knows? But I've forgotten what I was going to say then. But there are certain things that coming back to about compromise and other things like that, there are certain things that that we might be challenged with. And as I say, I've been looking at these different videos, etc. And we owe our liberty, we owe this book to a man that was burnt. I think he was, he wasn't burnt at the stake, didn't he? I think he was executed in a different way. But there are others. We owe this book and the liberty to be able to have it and live in a Protestant so-called country because of men and women who said, if not. And the if not didn't lead to deliverance. It led to death. And it led to sacrifice. And I think, Lord, am I willing to pay the price? It may not be the ultimate price, but are we willing to pay the price for what we want in the Lord and what we want to see God do in our nation? And it's a challenge again to all of us, isn't it? And I'm not leaving it as a negative. I want to be positive about it, because when God challenges us, then we have to rise to that. And I say, okay, Lord, what do you want me to do? What do you want me to be? What can I do? How can I pray? Etc., etc., to help. And it's not to bring about a revival. We don't bring it about ourselves, but we absolutely desperately need a move of God in our land. Because if not, I didn't say any more about that, but I just say, Lord, will you help us and give us the courage and the tenacity and the faithfulness of men and women like the ones we've been looking at tonight. Amen.
Amen.
Amen. The Lord bless you all. Praise.